Algorithmic risk assessment tools are used to determine who gets released on bail. Professor Buzz Scher joins me to discuss its effectiveness. This is the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about the law school and apply by visiting law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Buzz, to start off with, in the past, how has risk determined whether a defendant was released on bail or not?
It varies from state to state is the short, accurate, useless answer. But beyond that, a judge listens to a police officer or a prosecutor, listens to the defendant if he doesn't have counsel, or the lawyer representing the defendant, who say, you know, this person will show up, this person is not dangerous, and then the judge sets bail. One of the problems has been historically with that method is the judge just, in many states, and New Hampshire was very much like that, the judge would either have it like a schedule, an informal schedule, it's a burglary, bail gets set at X, and not do substantive quality evaluation of the particular individual in front of them. Whether they, you know, somebody who lives in a rural town or a rural county and essentially has never left the county or the state, bail should be set differently, even on a burglary charge, than somebody who's from Massachusetts or Vermont and is more likely to skip the jurisdiction. So there were problems with the old system of setting bail. One group of people said, let's regularize the system for assessing one piece of the bail consideration. That is the person going to commit a crime, a violent crime, while out on bail?
Or flee, I'm assuming.
Excuse me?
Or flee, I'm assuming.
No. Well, that's a separate risk assessment tool. Right. There's two different risk assessment tools. And there's a reason for that, mm-hmm. which I'll come to at some point probably. and so let's regularize that in a more efficient way by putting together a database and from that database creating an algorithm that you just fill in the algorithm questions, the algorithmic questions. Are there prior convictions? You know, for example, do they have prior convictions? Has he ever been convicted of violent crime? What's his age? What's his race? Things like that. And press the button and out comes the answer, the likelihood that this person will commit a violent crime while out on bail. This is a very specific, in theory, assessment. Are they going to commit a crime while out on a violent crime while out on bail? It's not a generalized, is this person as a general proposition dangerous? What should we sentence him to given his prior history and who he is after he's been convicted? It's neither of those two things. In theory, it should be only what is the likelihood that this person will commit a violent crime while out on bail? So that's what they're built for.
And how long has this been around?
Oh, they have 5 to 7 years.
Oh, wow. So it's really not that far back.
They started developing them 5 to 7 years ago. Yeah. I mean, people were thinking about it. And, you know, the cell is it's more efficient. It takes less time. We can punch in the right information. The information needed, and we can get an answer. And it makes a judge, one, it saves time, but two, it makes a judge feel like he or she are using science to come up with an objective, neutral decision. It relieves a judge of the, let's call it anxiety, or the angst that comes with making a tough decision. Are we going to hold this guy in jail before the trial? Because there are really negative consequences to doing so.
And there's a huge but, I'm assuming, at the end of this sentence.
Yeah, there is. there's a huge but, which is they're bad algorithms.
Right.
You know, the fundamental problem is this. The database you want to look at is all the people who have committed a violent crime while out on bail. That's the database you want to build your algorithm on. That there's just not that many people. less than 2% commit a violent crime.
Right. And if you're focusing just on this negative end of the spectrum, you're inherently going to have an algorithm that's going to send a lot more people in.
Right. And that's what's happening, it appears. Mm-hmm. New Jersey has been, they did a significant bail reform about 3 or 4 years ago, and they've been using these algorithmic bail decisions, and there's a lot of disgruntlement with them. There's a very good op-ed piece in the New York Times on this issue. It was by a law professor at Harvard Law School and two MIT professors who are familiar with creating algorithms, and they had deep concerns with this kind of algorithmic decision making or decision by algorithm. Mm-hmm. It's a problem that is a bigger issue culturally and societally than just using it to make this kind of decision. You know, algorithms. Are a form of artificial intelligence, right? And artificial intelligence is really popular right now. The idea of, in theory, objectifying hard decisions by turning it into an algorithm is very attractive.
Yes.
You know, juries, for example, aren't using algorithms to make decisions, but it's hard for a jury to decide who am I going to believe. You know, that's the hardest. Let me look at all the evidence and decide who I'm going to believe. Juries love, quote unquote, scientific evidence because it feels objective and it feels neutral and it feels like it takes away their need to make the tough decision. That's the same thing algorithms do. It turns out with juries, there's a lot of weakness in scientific evidence is not as objective and neutral.
If it looks like it's scientific, that'd probably be enough to convince a lot of people.
Yeah, well, there's a wonderful quote from an old case that judges should be concerned about the mystic infallibility of scientific evidence. And that's the same thing with algorithms. They have a mystic or mythic, pick your word, infallibility about them for most people. It's numbers, it's science. It gives us the answer, I don't have to make a tough decision. Yeah. And that's societally, that's an issue we're going to have to confront on oh so many fronts going forward. This is just the start of inching its way into the criminal justice system, but it's going to be used in, you know, other, you know, employment situations,
right.
Hiring decisions, firing decisions.
I just recorded two podcasts with Professor Bill Murphy on artificial intelligence. First, we did the history of it and machine learning mixed in there, and then going on the impact on the legal industry that it's having, which ultimately this is a part of. We didn't discuss this specifically, but it's a lot of data that's driven by what the person that designed the algorithm thinks you need as necessary information. So there could be all sorts of biases built into it from the person who did the coding. There could be certain aspects of the data weren't taken into consideration. For example, with this, if they didn't take into consideration the people that didn't commit a crime when they're out on bail, that obviously has an impact.
Which is the huge majority of people who are out on bail.
Yeah, the huge majority. I mean, you're completely disregarding the fact that, oh, maybe it's basically a coin toss when you get to a certain level in the algorithm.
And the final piece to it is the data entry piece.
Yes.
Who enters the data? Is it, you know, in some ways, in some jurisdictions, it had been set up until people were called out about this so that an employee from the prosecutor's office was the one who entered the data. That's obviously a big problematic. Should the judge be entering the data?
Yeah.
Who should be entering the data? Do you, you know, in the, not to speak well of algorithmic decision making on this one, but in those jurisdictions where it's done in a better fashion, they have an employee who is neither associated with the court or associated with the prosecution or the defense for that matter, do an interview with the individual and enter the appropriate information. But that's still, you know, that data entry piece has an additional layer of difficulty. If you're doing the data entry for me and I rub you the wrong way, is that at least unconsciously going to affect the way you translate the information I give you in putting and entering it into the algorithm? You know, there are all sorts of unconscious biases that it's hard to protect for, even at the data entry level, putting aside the quality of the database, yeah. which is a huge problem, the quality of the database on which the algorithm was developed. You know, there are the people who collect this data are numbers people who tend to have far less sensitivity to the important nuances of who people are in the criminal justice yeah. system. And, you know, you can make an argument that without those important nuances, it's a bad system, and you can't quantify the unquantifiable. There's a wonderful expression in another context talking about the role of hard data of numbers in jury decision making and in anybody's decision making. And what numbers, you know, what gets privileged is that which you can quantify in a number. It's not necessarily the most important factor in the decision, but it's a factor that's quantifiable.
Right.
And so the expression is what happens when you have numbers for some things, but no numbers for other things that are equally or maybe more important. What happens is the numbers dwarf the soft variables. That's the expression.
And now, is it just inevitable that a system like this might take over bail and how it's handled, or do you feel like it's still up in the air whether this is the long-term solution?
I think it's still up in the air, both in terms of the quality of the algorithms that need to be improved. But, you know, in New Hampshire, I was one of the people responsible for the very significant bail reform, and we did not include risk assessment tools. The court system itself looked at risk assessment tools and went back and forth on it, and the interdisciplinary committee chaired by the court system I think has really stopped seriously considering it. There's just a lot of, they didn't get to a place where they were comfortable with it. I don't want to speak for them, but my sense is, and sense only, they didn't get to a place where they felt comfortable with it. There was a lot of messiness depending on what county and what.
Yeah. I mean, that's a huge aspect of it, is location and community.
Huge. You know, location developed on a database that doesn't consider rural New England people or mm-hmm. rural Iowa people or rural Nevada people or rural Utah people.
It's a lot smaller populations, a lot harder to get numbers.
And the extent to, it's a lot harder, you know, the you can't get a reliable sample when you don't have enough numbers.
Yeah.
And rural people in Iowa, you know, the numbers you get from them, or rural people in Texas, the numbers you get from them might be enough, but do they really tell you about the likelihood of somebody from Pittsburgh, New Hampshire, committing a violent act when they're out on bail?
Yeah.
You know,
it's a different culture depending on where you are.
Very much so. And it is the cute and really true thing to say is it depends on the individual. That's how bail should be set. The beauty of the bail reform in New Hampshire is it forces judges, it sets some parameters. It says, you know, if there's no concern about failure to appear and dangerousness, you're out on bail. You get personal recognizance bail. If there's a concern about a failure to appear, you can set bail, but you got to set it in an amount that the person can make, thereby giving a financial incentive for that person to show up. If the person you can show by clear and convincing evidence the person is dangerous, then you can hold them without bail. But it's but you're entitled to a hearing where you're represented by counsel, and the prosecutor has got to actually call witnesses. So it's the bail reform statute really forces judges to make a more individualized decision on a case-by-case basis than any algorithm ever would. And you know, obviously my interest in the bail reform statute is clear, but I think it's a better system.
Thanks for listening to the UNH Law Podcast. Learn more about us by visiting law.unh.edu or following UNH Law on social media. Be sure to comment and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or Spotify. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or host and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire.